Welcome to the Lending Forward podcast, brought to you by Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group. This is your home for real discussions about the mortgage and housing industry. Our hosts are here bringing you firsthand accounts every week from people at the heart of the business. And we're chatting with professionals from all corners of the industry as they help cultivate transparency around the future of the industry we love. Together, we are lending forward all we know to you. Thanks for joining us for today's episode. Let's dive in.
Hey, we are back with another episode of Lending Forward. Hey, Eliza.
Woo. Hey, Hannah. It's good to be here. Excited to be here with Scott Olson from CHLA.
Yeah. Hey, Scott. Thanks for joining.
Good morning.
We're kind of coming in on some pretty sad news in our industry. I hate starting a podcast off with some sad news, but I thought we could maybe take a few minutes and celebrate the legacy of Dave Stevens. I know you were super close with him, Scott. So if you want to kick us off with just a little intel on how you knew Dave, how he impacted your life, and how he's kind of impacted the industry in a whole, I think he deserves a little spotlight.
Sure. And it is sad that the mortgage world is a little smaller today. Dave was, above everything else, he was sort of larger than life. You always noticed him because he was forceful and he was effective. And I got to know him when I was working on the House Financial Services Committee and he ran FHA. And, you know, I worked for Barney Frank on the committee. And Barney used to say, no one ever gives you credit for the horrible things that you averted through your hard work that were catastrophes that didn't happen. And that was the case with Dave. He took over right after the 2008 housing crisis and he guided FHA. And everyone, I mean, the mortgage business imploded. And not only did prices implode, but mortgage lending imploded. Fannie and Freddie turned very conservative. And it was FHA under Dave's stewardship that saved the housing market, stabilized them, saved them by jumping in and being aggressive and making mortgage loans to prop up the market. And in the process, FHA took some losses because they were, you know, you're like catching a falling knife, but they saved the market. And I thought he was brilliant the way he navigated that. But of course, it's a story that you can't tell. You can't tell what would have happened if he hadn't done that. But he deserves a lot of credit for that. And then, of course, he guided MBA through many years. And after he left, he was, you know, almost as impactful in the industry as when he was at MBA, because, you know, he regularly had opinions and things. And, you know, I've been pleased the last year or so. I've done a number of joint op-eds with him, including, you know, calling for the Fed to be buying mortgages. And so it's been great to work with him, but it's bit more than that. It was great to watch him all those years.
It was, and he was just so instrumental. I mean, he was at so many different events. I think all of us, and when I say all of us, I mean lenders, we always looked to him for guidance, for advice, for his opinion. His opinion mattered so much. And it's a sad week for sure. So
yeah.
Well, Scott, we're really grateful to have you on. We have a very broad listener base, so I would love for you to talk a little bit about you and CHLA. What is CHLA, and how are you all impacting the lending world?
Well, thank you. We launched this ship, I'm thinking back now, 12 years ago. And it was basically out of the opinion of a number of IMBs that there needed to be a national organization that was exclusively focused on IMBs, particularly community-based, small and mid-size, that would be a zealous advocate for things that are important to the industry, and then B, sort of a clearinghouse for people to talk with each other about distinctly IMB issues. And so we really carried that through to this day. And it's also, you know, I worked on the Hill and I'd watched different organizations, and I was not, you know, some of them they were kind of sort of stiltified in their presentations, and it was clear that they were sort of top down. And so, you know, we were determined to run what is a bottom up organization where the members really sort of run the place. And they, you know, on our weekly calls, they say, here's this thing we got to, this is a problem, we got to fix it, or here's what we're concerned about. And you know, members suggest 80 to 90% of the initiatives that we work on and prioritize. And then they play a big role. I mean, we're about to unroll a report on FICO, which is one of the things I hope we can talk about. And a lot of it was, you know, helped written by our members who know what's going on. So that's been our thing. And then the other aspect of that is we feel that we're the sort of distinctive voice for the industry. So every year we put out an annual IMB report, and, you know, hope, you know, if you look on our website, communitylender.org, at the top of the site, there's a link to the report. It's about 25 pages, a lot of details about what's going on in the IMB world, but also things like dispelling myths about IMBs. There's a lot of people that want to run around and say that they're the next big financial risk, which is a bunch of hokum. And so, you know, so we really try to sort of set the record straight. And so I hope people will go on our website, take a look at that, because we think that's an essential part of, you know, advocating to Capitol Hill, to federal agencies about what IMBs are. I mean, when I started work at CHLA, I was shocked, not just how little people on Capitol Hill knew about independent mortgage banks. I was shocked that myself, as the top housing staffer on the committee, how little I knew about IMBs. And I can admit it now, but I was pretty ignorant at the time. So God help people that were advocating on behalf of IMBs when they came to see me at the time, because it's just, I didn't really understand the industry. And so, you know, that's part of our job is to explain that to people in Washington.
Hey, Scott, I know you mentioned this as part of the big work that you guys are doing at your organization. You mentioned FICO and that the membership is working with you on, you know, how are you addressing the issue that we're facing with the FICO scores and that kind of thing. So can you describe what the issue is and how you're working to navigate that and, you know, make it better so that the listeners really understand what it is that's happening?
Yep. So our biggest challenge is to figure out whether to describe it as a monopoly or a quasi-monopoly. But basically, as we've learned the last year, they can charge and do whatever they want, because the major federal mortgage programs like FHA and Fannie and Freddie require credit, you know, this stuff. So the credit reports. So basically, a year ago, they raised prices on credit reports by 400%. So my math isn't that good, but since the last time they did it, if you factor out inflation, they only, you know, in their defense, they only raised it like 370% above inflation. So I guess I'll defend them that way. The other thing they did is they gave some sweetheart deal to about 51 lenders, which it was even hard to get the list of who had the preferred pricing. And that's really, that goes to one of the things that has been CHLA's biggest focus over the years, is to fight in pricing and GSE pricing, which we won some significant victories there, that players in the industry should not discriminate against smaller lenders. And that's exactly what they did last year. So we made a big stink about that, and we're happy to see that this year they dropped that. But instead, they went and they raised prices even more to 500% above where they were. So, you know, we have asked the regulators, I think this is a hard sell, we've asked Fannie, Freddie, FHA to say, look, you're requiring these things, you ought to regulate their prices, you ought to do something. But I know that's a heavy lift. So we think that, you know, in the long run, obviously doing things like getting Vantage score in the game and so on may help a little. But we think that jawboning and just trying to shine a spotlight on this is and try to shame them is probably our only recourse. So we've been trying to do that. But the other thing they did, which is really unfortunate, is just when I think it's Fannie, maybe it's Freddie, Fannie started to allow soft credit pulls in their approval process, they eliminated the lower rate for soft credit pulls. So they're always sort of like a step ahead of everyone in terms of raising prices. But the problem with that is that that's, you know, you want mortgage lenders to work with unripe borrowers that are, you know, want to get in the mortgage industry, want to position themselves so that they can get the first step, which is to qualify for a loan. So they have credit problems. You want people to work with them. It involves pulling credit reports. This has a cost. If you're basically discouraging that to happen because, you know, the lender has to eat these costs. And that's not to say they won't do it, but it's a horrible policy. And so precisely at a time when, you know, people like my kids who are in their 20s are come and ask me, you know, Dad, you're in the mortgage industry. How am I ever going to afford to buy a house in Washington, D.C.? And I say, I really don't have an answer for you. But part of the answer is we have to, like, make it easier. And these ridiculous, you know, these ridiculous prices make it harder for loan originators to work with those borrowers.
And how are those conversations going? I mean, how often are you all speaking to regulators? Is it fairly often?
We speak to regulators all the time. I mean, we have fly-ins, and that's one of the things about our organization you know, we have we're a smaller organization. So when we have a fly-in, we get to meet with the FHA commissioner or the FHFA director or the head of the CFPB, all of which we've done in the last year. It's like a group of, you know, 15 people, you know, 15 members that have come in or 20. And they get one-on-one exposure. So we have that, but we also have, you know, regular communication with their staff. And, you know, and in my case, I've worked with a lot of these people and we know them well. And so it's relatively easier to send notes and saying, hey, you know, we wanted to give you, I mean, one of the issues, for example, is we've been really making a big deal about repurchase demands and how that doesn't make any sense. And so we've made a big deal. We sent letters. There's been progress, but we're also regularly reporting back what our members like you say about, okay, this is what's happening. We're actually doing work on repurchase demands to try to illustrate what the problems are. And so we will say, okay, here's what's happening. They're doing this. They're a problem in appraisals or whatever. So we regularly provide communication to them. That's one of the most, not just advocating, but helping give them real world feedback. And because we're small and we stay close to our members, we actually hear directly from them what they're saying. So, but the FICO thing's a tough nut because I don't know what the answer is, but it just seems like it is a monopoly and that's just ridiculous.
I guess not being able to predict the outcome is the tough part because you don't know where they're gonna go or what they're eventually gonna decide. So we just gotta keep being loud about it.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I love that, you know, you're getting on the ground information from your members. I mean, you're not, and I, you know, sometimes I think that's half the issue is that the regulators don't really understand, okay, if we put this in place, this is how it's affecting lenders, is how it's affecting buyers. And it's very contradictory in the sense, like you said, we're fighting an affordability issue, yet we're allowing 400% increases
right
for a credit pull.
Let me give you a specific example of where the feedback's really important. Last year, FHFA, who's gone through different pricing changes, and we supported a lot of them, but they did this thing where they had a differential pricing based on debt to income, whether you were above and below the 40%. Well, you know, theoretically, that sounds like, you know, a reasonable thing to do. But because our members quickly were helped to put together a narrative about what that meant, how you could start a process where someone is below it, and then as you gathered underwriting information, all of a sudden they'd slip above it, and then they could slip below it, and you're going to have to call the borrower and say, I'm sorry to inform you that you know, suddenly your costs have gone up. And so we quickly put together a case that said, whatever benefit you're getting from doing this is outweighed by all these practical problems, and the narrative about the practical problems came from sitting on these calls and listening to people describe why that was a problem. And you know, 4 or 5 months later, they kicked that out. And so I think that's a feedback that's essential to advocating for what you're doing, because it's just say, we don't like this. It's like, yeah, whatever. You know, it's, when I worked on the Hill, I heard people say, we don't like this all the time. I sort of like, it went in one ear and out the other. If you say, we don't like it because it doesn't make sense because of whatever, then I'd sit up and pay attention.
You're coming back with, I don't like this, but you also have some facts behind it, which makes a huge difference.
Exactly. I don't like this. And furthermore, your consumers don't like this because blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. So you mentioned your annual IMB report, and I saw that it came out. I haven't read it yet. But are you still seeing that regulators and people on the Hill, these big decision makers, are still not fully grasping how different IMBs are and how we operate? Is that still, do you see that as still an issue?
I think it's an issue, and I think it's an issue when it comes to, for example, risk. In other words, you know, we've gone through, and this is a little bit in the rearview mirror, but a year or two ago, Ginnie Mae and Fannie and Freddie changed their financial requirements, and we pushed back in a number of ways. And I think that, you know, part of what we were saying was having to make the case that this is not like Silicon Valley Bank, which should have been safer because it was a bank. But, you know, if you read our report, we actually go through and say, if an IMB, a small IMB goes out of business, I think at one point the version I said is we're going to cry about it. Maybe I took that out, but, you know, we're going to be sad. But the main impact is that IMB won't be around tomorrow to make a loan. But they sell off, we explain the business, they sell off their loan to an aggregator or securitizer. And so unlike most financial firms that have assets on their books, and if that industry tanks, the firms tank financially, we don't, IMBs don't have those assets on their books. So they're not going to go, they're not going to go. I mean, this has been a horrendous period financially for IMBs because of the volume collapsing. But the IMBs didn't go under because they, you know, the few that have, because they financially collapsed. It was because they no longer were making money because their expenses exceeded their revenue. Their revenue fell in half, and they had to make. So we explain. I mean, go read it. We explain all that. You know, it's important to understand the bit. And by the way, Dave Stevens did a great job of this. So you have to understand the IMB business model to understand why these people run around and say that their IMBs are really risky or crazy. Now, there's a few very large mega servicers, you know, that if they one of them went out of business, that would be a problem. If a small servicer goes out of business, you're going to sell it to someone else, and Ginnie Mae is, you know, safe, you know, and so on. So that's, it's, as I said, a lot of it is explaining, is having to explain what IMBs are, to explain why we're opposing certain things or asking them to change certain things.
Well, let's go into my favorite topic, and probably everybody's, well, nobody's favorite topic. I want to talk about compensation. Okay. Because
that's my favorite topic.
let's just dig right in.
Okay.
IMBs are losing money. Mm-hmm. And comp is a very large line item in, you know, people's P&L. So where does the CHLA stand on LO comp from a risk standpoint, this is what you can and cannot do?
So you're talking to someone that worked for Mr. Frank that basically crafted this. I was somewhat involved in that, but it was a team effort. I mean, the whole purpose of LO comp, if you recall, was about brokers, where they would look around and see who would pay them the most to get the worst deal for the borrower.
Mm-hmm.
In the process, the LO comp rule, and particularly how it was being implemented, went a lot beyond that. Okay. And so it created, I really think it was really important to get that provision done to try to prevent the abuses. But in the strict reading of it, it's been counterproductive in certain ways. And we have argued pretty strongly that there are a number of specific areas that they need to create exceptions for, to everyone has to get paid the same amount. One is state bond deals. And so we've been pushing on that. We don't see why another. Another is if a loan originator makes an error, it seems like they ought to be able to be penalized for it, at least from the point of view of the government. But the big thing is this whole idea of if you work with someone for a while, help them over an extended period of time, get them the loan, and at the last minute they go shop the deal, that you can't to keep that customer, cut your fee. And so we've been pushing for we actually came up with a pretty detailed proposal that was more, I think, a lot more nuanced than what the other groups were doing, that sort of balances these issues to try to protect that. So I think it's a really complicated issue that I don't think the regulators fully appreciate the areas in which it has negative consequences. And we believe that you don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. The other thing is that, you know, we believe that, you know, there certainly are brokers that, because there's two channels, they can basically get around that, and that's a problem. And as in a practical world, brokers are small, so the CFPB isn't going to really do anything mm-hmm. about that, because they effectively have trouble going after people that small. But I don't know whether I answered your question. It's a really complicated issue. But in an environment in which margins are under severe pressure, I think that the anomalies in these situations are more significant. And so I'm hoping that we can re-engage, a dialogue that doesn't say, okay, this is an absolute that you can't ever do it, but to look at the practical realities. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I'm addressing the sort of the specific concerns that the people out there have.
Well, and that was kind of going to be my follow up question was, you know, since you do meet with your members often, are there common concerns with the LO comp rule that you're kind of hearing from your members?
Yeah, or is it? Those are the thing. I mean, like everything yeah. else we've done, when we emerge with a letter, a policy, an initiative, it kind of reflects, you know, hours of discussion among members until we reach a quasi consensus that those are the things, mm-hmm. those are the things that are important, but also those are the things that are achievable. We don't believe in Don Quixote. I mean, there's a lot of associations like they tilt at windmills because it looks good. And we don't ever do that because we don't have the bandwidth to go after stuff that just looks good to our members. We only work on stuff that we try to tailor what we're doing to what's achievable.
Okay. So on the comp.
By the way, I mean, I should tell you, over the years, we've had plenty of members on calls say, well, you should get rid of this. Well, that's fine. I mean, you can take a position, you should get rid of LO comp, but it's not really an effective use of your resources. But there have been a number of members that believe that. So, and I respect that. I'm just saying it's not achievable.
Right.
I think it's so interesting when you talk about, because my head immediately goes to when you're talking about like meeting with the regulators and talking with the regulators. My curiosity is, are there some regulators that are just easier to work with, or like what informs your agenda? Obviously, your membership gives you kind of the points of like the pain points and those kinds of things. But do you get a sense of when working with the regulators, some things are easier to move forward and solve with them? Obviously, intricacies are what they are. I would love to get a sense of like from the personality standpoint and the dynamics. Yeah.
You don't really believe I'm going to cite the regulators that I just think of by name, do you?
The enigma. I have to ask. I'm just curious. I know other people are curious about that too.
So basically, first of all, sort of you got me there. I gotta regain my composure. To me, talking to regulators is sort of like, and I can't remember, this is a long time ago, I've been married 26 years, it's sort of like going on your first couple dates. Is you're at that point, you're trying to think about what the other person wants to hear in the conversation. Yeah. but seriously, everyone, when you talk to a regulator, you have to like put yourself in their shoes, and you have to think about
yeah.
what they're trying to achieve, because you have to craft your arguments around why they ought to do it. And say, okay, if I'm the CFPB, I need to talk about this in not in terms of I want this, my member wants this, because they don't really care. And in fact, if you say, do this because my member wants it, you've probably hurt yourself a little bit. But to explain realistically why it just doesn't hurt us, but it hurts the customer, the consumers we're serving. I mean, for example, the GFI discrimination or other discrimination, it's sort of like, why is it fair that a particular consumer is hurt because they're working with this small lender as opposed to Rocket or whoever? That's not fair. That's not fair mm-hmm. to the consumer.
Yeah.
And so everything has to be explained in terms of understanding what the regulator's goal is, and then fashioning what you want that works with that. And if what you want is an antithetical to them, don't waste your time.
Which is, I mean, kind of the whole point of that question was also identifying like why roles like yours are so important, because you can translate kind of the needs of the membership and reflect it to and have that conversation right. effectively with the regulators on everybody's behalf. So not trying to pin anybody down about exactly. good or bad or, you know, that kind of thing. So, yeah, that's a good
no, it's, Eliza wants the dirt.
But the other thing is I think you end up having some recognition of their challenges. So on Elocomp, we talked about Elocomp. So I think that there are, over the years, and we've talked to, oh my God, three or four different CFPB directors about this. I think that there is some interest in their part in addressing the inflexibilities. But I think that they feel like it's sort of like you can't let you can't open the window a crack. If you allow one thing, then you opened up the whole thing and you're going to have everyone pushing to rip it apart. So a narrow exemption for this, for the bond deals or for this or that is a road that they're reluctant to go down, even though if you privately ask them, they might say, yeah, I would be okay with that. I don't really have an objection to that. And so I think that that's a real challenge. And it's part of, you know, the regulators not only have their own agenda and their own perspective, but they have to deal with, in some cases, if it's a federal rulemaking, really complicated things they have to go. I mean, to go like for FHA to do stuff, if they're doing a rulemaking on something, it's an extensive process and they have to take comment and then they can be challenged in court. So nothing's like running a business. You know, business, it's like, okay, this isn't working. Let's change our system or do this or whatever, but they're always looking over their shoulders. So I do have some sympathy as to why, and we try to help explain to members why things that, you know, why wouldn't they do that, sort of explain the challenges of that.
Do you see, I don't want to say delay, does this being an election year make a difference in the conversations?
Yeah, I think so, but not necessarily. I mean, I think it's hard to draw conclusions. I mean, to be blunt, if you're one of the appointees of the Biden administration, one way you could look at it is, you know, you might lose the election, and so you only have 10 months or 11 months left, so I better do the things that I want to do, so you're going to hurry up. On the other hand, it's like some of the things I want to do could be controversial. So I don't want to, you know, create problems. So I think it cuts both ways. Mm-hmm. The one thing I would say is that unfortunately from the days I was in Congress, I mean, Congress has become a legislative wasteland. I mean, they used to legislate, and they used to get things done, and they used to work together. I mean, I worked with, you know, some of my best friends are Republicans I worked with on the committee, and we worked together, and it was sort of like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Let's get things done. And now, unfortunately, it's become so partisan that even the stuff that's not partisan just gets, they don't know how to work together. And so, you know, I don't expect anything congressionally to pass in the next year. So in other years, you would expect that maybe they would work together to pass something that's politically popular and get it passed and try to create credit. But I think there's less of that right now. I mean, you know, we definitely have a you know, real problems in terms of, you know, down payment capabilities. And, you know, in another environment, I would have expected Congress to maybe pass something to provide a program for some sort of first time homeowner tax cut or down payment assistance or whatever. But just Congress has just changed so much that that's just not likely now.
And do you, not to get pessimistic, but do you think it's not likely ever, or do you think it's not likely just right now?
So since no one looks at these podcasts a year later, I guess I'll go out on a limb. I do think that risky looking like an idiot a year later, but I think that this is a, I think we have as long as I've been working in this stuff, which is now almost 30 years, everyone always claims there's a crisis, but I really think there's genuinely a crisis. I mean, we've had the run up in home prices, and you know, you just look at the data on the average age of new first time home buyers, and it keeps going up. And you know, like my question about my kids, and it's also this generational thing. You know, it's splits. So people like me who lived in Arlington, Virginia, and my house is going up in value tremendously. And so we have equity. I can help my kids, you know, with down payment assistance, and the kids whose parents didn't ride that big run up in prices, all they have is the fact that it's, you know, if you make a good wages, if you're a married couple and you make good wages in Northern Virginia, it's hard to find. I mean, it's hard to be able to buy a home. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a crisis. And then the rents, you know, particularly since COVID, have just skyrocketed. And so much of one's budget these days is for housing, whether it's homeownership or rentals, that I think that I'm surprised that there isn't more of a focus in the campaigns on this issue, because I think mm-hmm. it's on a lot of people's minds. And I do believe in the next couple years that there will be more of a focus in Congress and more of a focus on trying to overcome these issues, because it's a huge problem. It's one of the biggest issues that we face.
Mm-hmm. And I think our entire listener base is hopeful that housing becomes a hot ticket item sooner rather than later. But I do, you know, I do think that CHLA is doing a lot for our industry. I think y'all are doing phenomenal things for independent mortgage bankers.
Thank you.
You know, going into 2024, I know you all have some top priorities, but how do you all plan on lending it forward this year? And Scott, you can take that any way you want, but
sure.
We like to ask everybody.
So in our report, we put out a list of our top policy initiatives, and we'd ask people to take a look at that. I mean, I think we have a lot of things we're working on. Clearly, you know, we can't directly affect that, but mortgage rates are absolutely critical to the industry, and we've seen some rallying in the bond market, and we hope that continues. We'd like to see some of these issues like FICO, and we'd like to see, you know, trigger leads. That's been a big issue. Our members complain about it all the time. We'd like to see that controlled. And then, you know, we're keeping an eye on Sitzer. We went out publicly and said we don't know where this is going, but just if you end up having the buyer, you know, buyers that are underserved and borrowers that don't have down payment capabilities, if they have to pay the broker, there could be problems in terms of affordability. And we've started conversations with FHA and the regulators about that. These are important issues from the lender point of view. I would say from our members' direct interest point of view, the repurchase stuff, we need to move away from repurchase as a model to indemnification at a fair level. So we've seen progress, but that's a really high priority, because it's not just bad for our members, and it's incredibly inefficient, but it's bad for borrowers when a repurchase takes place. They lose their loss mitigation rights. You're discouraging lenders from making loans to underserved borrowers because those are the ones that are more likely to go into repurchase. So that's a really, really high priority for us. And then we work on things that are longer term. We've been pushing on life of loan on FHA for many, many years. We're really happy to see the HUD secretary in a hearing this week say that they were interested in taking a look at that. I mean, we've been, CHLA has been an industry leader in pushing for premium hikes both in 2015 and last year. And, you know, so we're really pleased to see those go forward. But this is the last piece of undoing all the changes that FHA made in the last 15 years after the crisis that we want to see done. So we have a lot of things. And as I said, it's sort of we try to keep a lot of balls in the air, but we try to focus in any period of time on what's doable, because that's the only real purpose of advocacy is to get things done. So
you guys are doing so much. And I mean, like I said, we all appreciate all the hard work that you all do for us. And I hope you're okay, but we will be calling you back on later this year to get an update to see how things are going and just have another conversation with you. But, well, you know, Eliza and I are so grateful to have you on. We just thank you so much, Scott.
Well, I'd love to come back, and I've enjoyed this conversation.
Thanks again for tuning into today's episode of the Lending Forward podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our channel, follow us on Instagram at Lending Forward, on YouTube, and LinkedIn. Tune in next week for another new episode and go lend something forward today. Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group, LLC, NMLS number 72043, NMLSConsumerAccess.org is an equal opportunity lender and employer. Located at 600 Lynn Haven Parkway, Suite 100, Virginia Beach, Virginia 23452.